Welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, and on the line right now, joining me from Chicago, Illinois, CBSSports.com senior college football columnist Dennis Dodd. Dennis, I had a great show plan. Everything was laid out, and then, as it always does in our industry, news happened. So you are in Chicago for the BCS meetings, right?
I am.
So is there any reaction yet there about the news that the NCAA will begin reducing the scholarship sanctions against Penn State?
Not really. The Big Ten released a statement saying, you know, kind of lauding the effort of Penn State and the NCAA, and that the Big Ten was looped in on this from the beginning. I mean, don't forget that, you know, the Big Ten had to officially sanction Penn State and keep them out of their championship game.
Right.
And withhold their share of bowl money, the length of this deal. They did not address that in the statement. I did notice from the NCAA that sort of like a disclaimer, a clause, if Penn State keeps minding its own business and does everything right, there may be more relief. And I took that to mean bowls. And that would basically leave only the financial penalties. If Bill Brent could get the bowls back, it would be a great day for Penn State, because that makes it more unlikely that he would leave for the NFL.
In the post-SMU death penalty era, it has been my observation that vacating wins is not really going to do anything to significantly damage a program. You know, that might damage a reputation. What has taken hold is the loss of scholarships for the future, because it affects your recruiting as far as what you're able to offer, but it also affects your depth during the season and causes a whole other host of issues. Bill O'Brien called this tremendous as far as the NCAA giving back some of these scholarships over the next 3 years. And I think that what he said that really rang true with me is that Penn State has never had an issue in the Bill O'Brien tenure convincing an individual that they should come to Penn State. It was the numbers game of knowing you only have but so many scholarships, so they had to pick and choose as coaches. And maybe if they had a few more scholarships, would have invested time differently, which could have helped their overall end recruiting game. I think this is huge for Penn State as a football program. Does it signify that there was any real change at Penn State as far as the school and their, you know, their public statement of trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Well, I think that's the question. You know, what has changed here from July 23rd, 2012, that makes this any more unlikely that it'll happen again? We're talking about Jerry Sandusky. And they had a list of 119, basically a punch list of 119 things that they had to do to shore up the athletic department. And last I checked, when I started hearing about this, they had fulfilled about 110 of those. So you're kind of getting wind that George Mitchell was going to recommend that they be given some relief on this thing. So, you know, I think there's a whole other issue if you want to get into it. But, you know, I asked the question that day in Indianapolis, you know, is this precedent setting? Does this put everyone on notice that they could be punished essentially for something non-athletic related, non-enforcement related? Mark Emmert said, no, this doesn't open Pandora's box. It isn't precedent setting. Well, if that wasn't, this sure
is.
As heck is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this was not an appeal. This was not through the appeals committee. This was through the largesse of the NCAA, basically saying, I mean, I don't know if it's perceived this way, that, you know, one, we went too far. You know, and second, that Penn State didn't deserve this, and has done everything right since then. So that's my take on it right now.
Now, there is another side to this, which, again, I think you have hinted at a little bit in your breakdown, that the NCAA is going through a steps that indicate like they are trying to save their reputation. Mark Emmert has consistently regurgitated the story about this change that's coming in future months, and now they're coming back. And I think if they come back a year from now with even getting rid of the postseason ban, you know, this is a lot of efforts that seem to be more on the PR front than anything else. First, do you think that is something that's big that's in play here?
Yeah, I do think in the Penn State situation, I do. I mean, don't underestimate the PR element of this. The NCAA looks good. They look human. You know, they're giving back on what I think most of the nation perceived as them going too far with Penn State. I mean, it was heinous what happened. But, you know, I don't know if a lot of people thought it was fair to punish athletes and coaches that had nothing to do with it and go off the reservation in doing it for those penalties. So I think there is that component. I do see the NCAA kind of trying now to lead from behind. You saw it in July when the commissioners came out almost as one and called for reform, each in a different way. And the NCAA, Mark Emmert immediately said, oh, we welcome this discourse. We're going to have a big summit at the convention in January in San Diego. Now they're sending out surveys to administrators. What would you like the board of directors to look like in the future? I think they're missing the point with that. I think the reform in some ways is beyond the NCAA. It's going to be controlled by the commissioners who control things anyway now, it seems like.
Right.
And that there may not be a board of, you know, who says there's going to be a board of directors? That's my point. I mean, I don't know what it will look like, but it may not look like anything that we've even heard of. I mean, I hear speculation of, you know, different governing bodies for each sport. You know, have 15 people run football, and then there's a chairman, commissioner, what have you. Have 15 people run volleyball, because it's ludicrous for example, volleyball and football to adhere to some of the same rules. It just is. So be more specific, be more sensitive to the needs of those sports, and don't be so autocratic. And I think that will come from pressure applied by the commissioners, not so much by the NCAA leading on its own, because the presidents have already said they absolutely have no appetite for paying players. That's not going to happen. So, again, what are we left with? And it may be some of this stuff that I just mentioned, the specific committees.
So if the ship has sailed on the NCAA being able to sort of take control of college football, you know, I wonder what these next couple months are going to be like, because it seems to me, with everyone knowing that college sports is really sort of on this about to jump over the cliff, and no one really knows what the future is going to hold, it seems like everybody is going into a bunker mentality to try and make sure that they get what they want. You know, the NCAA wants to preserve its status right now, so they are trying to get huddled together, and you are seeing the NCAA be more proactive than they've ever been before. That I think that you can even point to this time of change as what we're seeing from the players with the All Players United, the APU movement. You know, they are making sure that they get organized. The conference commissioners are really the only ones that have gotten ahead of everybody and seem to be dictating this discussion.
I think you've touched on it with the players. I think they're becoming more aware, and I don't want to make this this analogy totally, but more like the 60s when students became socially aware in college, and it led to really a revolution in the country, the way we, you know, civil rights, everything else. And I think more players are more in tune with the issues. They can't help but hear about these concussion issues and brain trauma. They have to have some sort of view on how, you know, their jersey is being sold and they don't get any remuneration. And that's what you saw from those 28 players over the weekend. I think it's going to grow. I don't know what the end game is, but I don't think it's going to go away. You already see some backlash from coaches. Paul Johnson kind of spoke out on some of his players doing this. I talked to Pat Fitzgerald here in Chicago on Northwestern. He was upset that Kane Coulter, who's really the face of this now, he's the most well-known player, didn't vet it through him or the players' leadership committee. And I get that.
Right.
You know, that's kind of going off the reservation a little bit. I don't think it diminishes his message, and I don't think he should be, he should be muzzled because of that, and I don't think he will. But I think because of the fact those players did that shows just how serious it's gotten. And they, in some small way, realize that they have leverage. You know, they control the product.
Right.
If they choose to not come out for a game or boycott or make some symbolic gesture, they are the product. And they have to realize that in some small way now.
Do you see, and I know you already said you don't know what the end game is,
yeah,
but with so many issues sort of at hand right now, from the simplest issue, you know, who's going to be on the selection committee, all the way to the much bigger issues, like the players are out here talking about compensation and the concussion issues, two of the hottest and hardest topics in all of college sports. What, if anything, do you think that they would be able to accomplish as we sort of enter this new era?
Well, you mentioned the compensation issue. The sides basically agree on that. I mean, you know, Jim Delaney is out there saying, you know, we should have some sort of stipend. And that's what one of the things that this National College Players Association, which started the APU movement, that's one of their bullet points that they want to raise awareness on this. Now, I think the concussion thing is going to be resolved, not resolved, but come to a head, and not, no pun intended, in some kind of way. The players are going to have to be protected further by the NCAA, which really doesn't have a stomach for that, but may be forced to. There's a thing called standard of care in every medical situation, and it comes down to who owes that standard of care or duty of care. The NCAA doesn't want to be the duty of care. They want to say, hey, schools, conferences, do whatever you want, but we're not going to tell you what to do in the big picture. Well, that's what these lawsuits are about, and they're going to have to take responsibility for some sort of duty of care.
What is, moving a little bit from the NCAA to these BCS meetings, what is the, are you expecting will come out of these sort of final BCS meetings, sort of as they transition it to the college football playoff meetings?
Well, we told it that this one's going to be very quiet. They're meeting for 3 hours. It's part of a larger CCA meeting, the Collegiate Commissioners Association. So they're here for that, and they're meeting within that structure to talk about this. You know, I told Bill Hancock when I wrote my story last week about them being basically done with the members of the committee. I said, you've got about 11 months to launch this thing. Are you about ready to go? And he said, no. you know, when we announce the names, we're probably not going to track them out because logistically, that's probably not going to work to get them all in one place. Plus, I do think they want to keep these guys, if at all possible, as low-key as possible. We know that's not going to be the case. When we get the names, we're literally, the media are going to do criminal background checks on some of these people. Some will know, some we won't as well. You know, for one big question I have, everybody's going to have to graduate from somewhere. Does that person or has that person ever contributed financially to the athletic department of his alma mater? I don't think that can happen anymore with these people. And we're talking about former coaches, presidents, administrators, even media, to give it as clear an objective a case as you can present. So, no, they're going to try to keep them anonymous as long as they can, and it's not going to happen at this meeting. They're not going to announce that. I do know that a portion of the commissioners who have served on the basketball committee are going to meet and just discuss how that might work with this committee, because there are going to be a lot of similarities.
Our colleague Tony Barnhart, I've heard him make the point over and over again. I think he might have even said the same thing when we were meeting in Fort Lauderdale over the summer. Mm-hmm. You know, his sort of phrase is everybody went somewhere, especially for the ones that have been in college sports for a while. I would imagine that many of them have made contributions to their alma mater.
Well, and that's a question I have. Yeah, Tony and I have talked about that. And look, in the basketball committee, no one really cares. Because, first of all, it's established. his credibility is pretty much set. He's got a way larger sample size, 35, 37 games. And all you're doing is selecting 37 at-large teams and seeding them in the bracket. The 31 conference champions take care of themselves. So it's much different. I don't think they can go in the football selection committee with kind of this organic, well, this is just the way we felt. You know, there's going to have to be some sort of metric or metrics. They have the RPI. It's not the end all. We're told that. But at least it's available. We can see where teams stand. We know the automatics get in. And, look, if there's any controversy at all, it's about that last team in or last few teams in.
Or the seeding.
And it lasts maybe 12 hours. Because now they're playing the games already on Tuesday. So we're already into the tournament. And this thing could be, week to week. If they give us who they're thinking about on, let's say, I don't know, mid-November, and those top four teams all win the rest of their games, and on December 7th, the last day of the season, there are two different teams in there, they got some explaining to do. You know, what happened? You know, the teams you told us were the top four in the country all won their games. Why are two of them gone? I mean, that's just an example.
Right.
What about 2009 when you had five undefeated? You had TCU, Boise, and Cincinnati among them. What do you do then? Now, that's not likely to happen that often, but a bunch of one-loss teams sure are. And what the BCS era has taught us is that you don't even have to win your division to get in. That happened with a two-team championship game. What about a four-team? So what divisional play and realignment and expansion has done is really devalued conference champions as an entity, because you don't have to win your conference to win a national championship. And I'm not so sure that's bad. It's probably fair, but it has devalued those conference championships.
Well, especially the argument is stronger in it's funny because the argument is stronger in a league where everybody seems to complain about the schedule. You know, that it seems to be more likely in the SEC because you have such an unbalance between who's got the different stronger or weaker schedule. The Big 12, there will never be a debate about, you know, whether the conference champion is the best in the conference, but you'll also probably never get an undefeated Big 12 conference champion because it's so hard to win all nine of those conference games.
Well, and what decision do they have to make by not playing a conference championship game? Is that good or bad? They've already lost traction in 11 with Oklahoma State because they didn't play a conference championship game. I don't know where that's headed for them, but I think what will happen, and you mentioned, the teams don't play each other in this era of the Super Conference. You know, who doesn't play Michigan and Ohio State? I think that was the case with Northwestern last year. Well, they won 10 games. They're playing Ohio State and Wisconsin this year. So, you know, and the same thing's going to come about with LSU. Alabama doesn't play the top three in the East. That makes it pretty darn easy for them. What I'm convinced now is a team that's got some flaws. But you may not know it until later because they don't play the top three teams in the East. So, those are all issues to comprehend in the future.
From hypothetical conference standings to actual football, you mentioned earlier one of the reasons why we're able to forget the controversies because there's games, and I think it is one of my favorite parts about this 2013 season is that these conference commissioners, Mark Emmert, everyone else, it seems like everyone wants to hold off the real decision-making until after the season is completed so we can focus on things like LSU going between the hedges to go play Georgia in one. I mean, it's a top 10 matchup, but it really is huge, particularly when you look at Georgia. They've got that win against South Carolina. They do not want to be able to open up that SEC East. Florida really struggling offensively. This is a huge opportunity for them at home. And LSU looks as good as any team in the SEC, I'd argue. What are you looking for from each of these teams, and how do you see this one playing out?
I think, to me, clearly LSU is the second-best team now. They're balanced because of the offense now, because of Cam Cameron. Dak Mettenberger is a weapon. They have veteran receivers. I don't think people realize how good Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry are. Jeremy Hill, as flawed as he is off the field, might be better than Todd Gurley. And it's all said and done. He's coming off a career high. I think LSU feels really good about itself. Georgia can't afford to lose again. They're already going to be, when you lose one of those conference games — this isn't a divisional game, but it is a conference game — when you lose a division game, you're already two games behind because you can't tie, because the team that beat you holds a tiebreaker. So they can't afford to lose another conference game. They just can't. There's a little bit of desperation there, but I think LSU is a more complete team. I think they're going to win.
You can take Kenny Bell, you can take Norwood, and you can have Amari Cooper, and I think I would rather have Landry and Beckham. I think they are both playing so, so well, and to be paired with a more confident, a more assertive Zach Mettenberger, mm-hmm. it is really, really something to watch there at LSU. The competition, I mean, they beat TCU when Casey Paul-Hall was still there, so while TCU might be struggling now, I think you still give that win some credit. And the score of that Auburn game, to me, did not dictate at all the way the game went, because LSU was up 21-0 at halftime, and all the fans left, and the rain was pouring down. I give credit to Gus Malzahn and that young Tigers team for being able to push LSU, but every single time Auburn scored, LSU had an answer. They look, like you said, they look like a complete team that is a championship-level team. But going to beat Georgia as the 3-point favorites at home in this game, this is going to be huge for them. And then past that, LSU still has to play Texas A&M and Alabama. It's just a really, really tough for me to imagine LSU, a team that looking at them looks like one of the best teams in the SEC. I don't know if I could see them winning the SEC because of that schedule.
Yeah, it's going to be hard, like you said, because Alabama doesn't play those teams, and LSU has a tougher schedule.
And LSU has Florida, too, of course. I mean, that's no easy challenge.
Yeah, so it's another example why it's the toughest conference. Why Georgia is going to be supremely motivated to get back to that championship game for a third time, because they believe in the heart of hearts. They had Alabama beat and probably think they can beat them now, which they probably can. But they have to get over these significant hurdles. The only one that's kind of taken itself out of the mix is Florida. I think a lot of fans are thinking, with Jeff Driscoll, it's addition by subtraction. But I don't think you can, stick Murphy in there and automatically assume things are going to be better, because I know he was 8-for-14 Saturday. I need to see him make some winning plays with his arm or defenses of the stack, the line, and stop him. So I think that really hurts their effort. And that's assuming he gets through the season. If he's a running quarterback, he's going to take some hits in the SEC.
Yeah, I don't know if Florida beats Georgia or South Carolina right now, even with Murphy there. And when you get those two losses right there, you're just sort of working yourself out of the SEC East race.
Yep. I think you said it perfectly.
All right, so we got Wisconsin going to play Ohio State. Wisconsin looking very, very good. The only blemish on their record is the controversial ending to Arizona State. Very convincing win, 41-10 against Purdue. Ohio State has been rolling through opponents, but they've been doing so with backup quarterback Kenny Guyton, who is even setting single-game school records with one half of play. Braxton Miller has been cleared to play. Urban Meyer says he's 90%. With this primetime game, I'm assuming that he's going to be out there. this is huge because Wisconsin, to me, seems like the only team in that division that could potentially be a stumbling block for Ohio State to get to the Big Ten championship game. But Dennis, let's be honest, Ohio State's got their eyes set on much larger goals, which require no losses whatsoever.
Yeah, don't forget they have, you know, the longest winning streak in the country at 16 games in a row, and they basically need to keep that going to get to that championship game. So you're right. I think we all agree now that Ohio State might have the best quarterback depth in the country.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Kenny Guyton was a guy who, when Urban Meyer came in, he was this close to just letting him go, kicking him off the team. It just, the buy-in wasn't there. But, you know, now it is. He's a great athlete. He saved a bacon against Purdue last year. You know, that was a nice scrimmage they had on Saturday. But Braxton Miller, now a year older, a year wiser, is one of the most fantastic players in the country. He was on the top of a lot of Heisman lists before the season. So I think he'll be, I do think he'll be featured a lot on Saturday. And Wisconsin will stay in the game for a long, long time with Melvin Gordon and James White. I mean, that's what Big Ten teams like them do. And that front seven of Ohio State isn't built to shut them down. Not quite yet. So I think it'll be somewhat of a shootout and it'll be close.
I'm really looking forward to it. I've enjoyed watching Wisconsin play because I was fascinated. You know, Brett Bielema ups and leaves and really one of the shocking coaching moves of last offseason, including the almost second most shocking, Gary Anderson. People never thought he would leave. He comes in, and that team is just still doing so much of the fun. Just Melvin Gordon averaging almost 9 yards a carry. Just hand it to him on first down. And Joel Stavi, who's my question mark offensively coming into the season, he doesn't even have to do anything because he's never facing more than third and three.
Yeah. And the only thing he didn't do is work on his centering the ball technique in the offseason. That and the Pac-12 officials may cost them a BCS bid.
Speaking of the BCS bids, I wonder, because we've sort of grown accustomed to understanding that a one-loss SEC team is likely not out of the national championship picture just because of how strong that conference is and how good so many of those teams are. I think that the popular opinion is definitely in the Big Ten, definitely in the ACC. If you lose once, you're pretty much out of the hunt for one of those two spots. But, man, with as strong as the Pac-12 has looked so far this year, especially with the power in the North between Oregon, Stanford, and now Washington, and as good as UCLA has looked at times this season, I would argue that just because a Pac-12 team loses, if it's to another one of those powers, there is no reason that they should be dropped that much farther because I just think that conference is so good this year, easily the number two.
Yeah, and I wrote about that last week. But to your point, especially if it's Stanford or Oregon, they can almost absorb a close loss like it was last year, 17-14 Stanford in overtime. So, yeah, I think the pollsters have bought into their legitimacy. I think college football fans are. It may be a prohibitive distance between the Pac-12 and SEC, but I don't think there's any shame in that and saying they're the solid number two this year. Seven new coaches in the last 2 years. Going into last week, this may still be the case, Bishop Sankey was the leading rusher in the country of Washington. They had more teams in the top 25 in total defense in the SEC and five teams in total offense in the top 25 as well, which may have been more than any other conference. So it's pretty diverse. There's good young coaches. There's teams on the rise. And I think at least two teams there to me to get the national championship.
You know, I'm not sure if Bishop Sankey is leading the nation in rushing because I do know they gave him the rest of the day off after he went 77 yards on his first four carries in Washington's convincing win on Saturday.
Right.
So he's Washington looking really good. They are at home with Arizona, Kadeem Carey coming in there. Big test for Washington defensive coordinator Justin Wilcox's crew. That is a defense that has improved over the last 2 years since he's gotten there. And back to UCLA, they're the real stinker in this whole operation for me because they look really good this year, and they play Stanford, Oregon, and Washington.
Right. And until further notice, they own L.A.
Yeah.
Taking it away from USC officially for the first time in over a decade now, because what you can't be in L.A. is boring, and USC is boring. That will get Lane Kiffin fired more than anything else, more than an 8-4 record. It'll be a boring 8-4, and we've already seen that with the way the offense is operating. But you're right about UCLA. They will get a chance to prove themselves, and I think they're pretty solid. I mean, what they did last week I thought was really impressive, and then obviously going to Nebraska, taking care of business as well. Jim Moore's trying. They're not exactly an NFL offense, but I think they're run like an NFL team, if that makes sense. They've got that precision. They've got that, the work ethic. And that's something just that wasn't there under Rick Neuheisel. In the past, they were bad offensively, which didn't make any sense at all with him. But they're more balanced this time. Anthony Barr is one of the top defensive players in the country, a converted running back. He's an absolute monster.
I like Kendricks, too.
We shall see.
All right, send you out of here with this, since it's sort of the conference in your backyard. What is your take on this first month of the Big 12? Baylor, I sort of went out on a limb predicting that they might sort of sneak out and be the champions, and now they are looking like some legitimate front runners. I think we learned a lot about Oklahoma State as they go to West Virginia. I think that is a game where if you believe in Oklahoma State, you'd like to see them really, really take care of business, a big win. And then Oklahoma going on the road to Notre Dame as 3.5-point favorites over the Fighting Irish. Blake Bell going up against a good defense that will force him to show off that improved throwing arm. Where do you see the state of the Big 12, and who do you see emerging as with the BCS bid?
I think the number one story at this point is the fact that Baylor could win it. They're the first team in pretty much forever to score at least 69 points in their first three games, and I won't bore you with the numbers, but their time of possession is near the bottom. Obviously, 26 minutes 5 seconds per game. They're snapping the ball every 20 seconds. They're gaining 9-10 yards a snap. It has the look, and I know the competition is part of it, but as Oregon of the Prairie, if you will. Lake Seastrunk is following up on what he did last year. Bryce Petty looks like he's more of a trigger man than RG3 was in college, without the legs. And the receivers are underrated. The defense is better. If you look at what they did to Louisiana Monroe compared to Oklahoma, they did just as good as Oklahoma and shut Louisiana Monroe down. So that's a feature that no one's talking about. So I think with that offense and that league, if it comes to it, they can go undefeated and outscore everybody they play. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think they get Oklahoma at home.
Yes.
I think that's the case.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to check this. I think they play on that last Saturday. I'm not sure of all the championship games, which will make it real interesting in the Big 12. So, and Art Briles has made himself a hot name in the coaching circles. I don't think Texas would hire him, but I think that's on Texas. They'd be making a mistake, because they're never going to hire a guy from Baylor. Well, that would be on them. He's a hell of a coach.
Well, that last Saturday, and yes, they do get Oklahoma at home. They get Texas Tech at home. They've got West Virginia at home next week. They go on the road to face Oklahoma State, but then they get Kansas and TCU on the road. Those are favorable road matchups. And that last Saturday that you mentioned, it's the Longhorns coming to Waco. Wouldn't that be something if they were undefeated going into that Texas game?
Yeah. A lot of us would be. A lot of us would not be at the SEC game that day, because that's going to be a heck of a story. Yeah, I mean, Baylor's such a good story because, you know, we all know the scandal they went through with the basketball and a murder there and everything. But out of that rubble, they've built a consistent top 25 basketball program, national champion in women's basketball, a team in football now step to go to a BCS bowl. That to me is amazing. I bet 90% of people who are listening to this can't even name their athletic director who oversees this. And their president is Judge Kenneth Starr from the Clinton presidency days, from Whitewater. It's a very colorful story, I'll say that.
For sure. Well, be sure, if you are not already, that you follow Dennis Dodd on Twitter, at Dennis Dodd CBS. He will be tweeting and reporting from Chicago. And where will you be this weekend?
Wisconsin and Ohio State.
Oh, wow. I'm very, very, very envious of you. I will be at the center, the CBSSports.com Raleigh headquarters with all of my screens, taking in all the football and telling you about it, the rest of the country.
Well, let me know what happens, because that's one of the downsides of this. When we're in that press box, we're kind of isolated. But I'm not complaining.
That's right. for Dennis Dodd, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.